What I'd like to do for this week, instead of actually doing the Parsha, because it's so close to Purim, I'd like to spend a little time on the Megillah. Now, I'm not going to actually go through the storyline of the Megillah per se. If you want to spend time and really get to understand the Megillah, I do recommend the four CD set called Megillah's Esther, The Story Behind the Story. It's both available on CD as well as on the site for a download. But what I'd like to do here is just take little snippets, almost little pieces of the Megillah, and see if we could learn certain yesodos, certain concepts from it, and see if we could find chidushim there. So let's begin with the following. The first pasuk says, "Vahimi bimei Achashverosh." It was in the days of Achashverosh. Who Achashverosh? He was Achashverosh. Hamolech mehodu vat Kush. He ruled from Hodu to Kush. Sheva ve'esrim umeya medina. 127 medinas. Now Rashi corrects the very first mistake that people make when they look at the Megillah. The normal assumption is that Achashverosh was this roly-poly kind of guy, jolly fellow, kind of like the Pillsbury Doughboy. You know, you push him in the belly and you know, Haman comes to him with this idea. You know, you never heard of these people. They're scattered. You don't know about them. Let's kill them. Oh, sure, says Achashverosh. Esther comes later and says, someone's tried to kill my people. Who is this? He doesn't know what's going on. He's kind of this jolly kind of fellow. And Rashi, on the very first pasuk, says, who Achashverosh? Why did the Torah repeat? Why did the Nach repeat the fact that he is Achashverosh? Who berisho mitchiloso vatsofo? He in his wickedness from the beginning to the end. And not just that, Rashi explains to us, what does it mean? Hamolech, who ruled from Hodu v'Kush. It should have said he ruled, past tense. Why is it Hove? Explains Shemalach me'atzmo. He ruled on his own v'lahaya mizarim lucha. He was not born to monarchy. This man clawed, fought, scratched, and bit his way up into power. He was an extremely ambitious, extremely driven, extremely evil human being. His goal was world dominion. He had achieved that, and he was in the height of power, and the Megillah opens up to explain to us who he was. But just to give you almost an illustration of how evil the man was, later on in the story, the Megillah opens up in the third year of the reign of Achashverosh. In year 7, when actually Esther is chosen, and shortly thereafter, the entire event, Haman has the decree set, comes to Achashverosh, let's write it into an Igeris. They send the Igeris out, and Mordechai comes to Esther and says, go to the king. Go to the king and be mischanim, beg for mercy. Says Esther back to Mordechai, it's very, very dangerous for me to go. Why? Because kol ish v'isha, every man and every woman, asher yovel al melech ha-chatzar pnimis, any man or woman who goes into the inner chamber of the king, asher li'kari, who is not called, achas dasu l'hamis, is murdered on the spot. The queen, as much as she was favored, as much as she was loved by Achashverosh, was afraid to enter the king's royal chamber because the standard procedure was murder the individual. If you came to Achashverosh without being specifically called, there were two guards who stood at his side. They would walk out and murder you on the floor. And as a matter of fact, the Midrash tells us that's in fact what happened. Esther entered, and the two guards stepped forward. They immediately stepped forward. A malach came and quickly pushed the sharbit azav, the scepter, golden scepter that Achashverosh was holding, put it down. Then the guards saw that the scepter went down. They immediately stepped back. But the queen would have been murdered on the royal throne floor because how dare you enter my chamber without being invited? This man was no Pillsbury Doughboy. This man was an evil despot who was feared, who was very, very powerful. And the Megillah Storim, the Nesivos on the Megillah, clues us into something very, very insightful. The first pasuk tells us that he ruled over 127 medinas. We assume that he was obviously in the height of his power. I mean, my goodness, what a powerful man. Yet the Gemara tells us that this was not really the height of his power. Achashverosh was one of the four men who were slated to rule over Kippah. Kippah means like a yarmulke, the globe, the entire inhabited civilized world. Achashverosh had earlier in his life ruled over that Kippah, ruled over civilization. At this point in his life, he only is ruling over 127 medinas. The Megillah Storim, the Nesivos, explains to us that he had just recently lost 113 medinos. A medina is a city-state, a large province. He now ruled over 127. He had just recently lost 113, meaning to say, by all rights, This man should have been broken, should have been depressed. Here's an ambitious, driven fellow who had been the world monarch, the king, the emperor of the earth. And he had just lost half of his melucha. Almost half of his monarchy had been ripped from him. Yet, the Nesivos points out, that he made a mishta, he made a party. One of the reasons why he made this party is because he was joyous, because he saw something very, very unique. Chazal tell us that in our entire exile, in the thousands of years of exile that we are slated to be in, throughout it all, Hashem always scatters the Jewish people across the four corners of the earth. Never is it that we are under one monarch, because if that king turns evil, he'd be able to kill the Jewish people. So Hashem, in his infinite mercy, always spreads the Jewish people out, so that even if one king happens to rise who's evil and wants to kill out the Jews, he might succeed in killing a part of the nation, but there'll be other Sheiris HaPleita, there'll be other Jews remaining in other provinces. He won't be able to kill out the entire nation. And that historically has been the Jewish nation's exile. That's been history, that's been reality. Ahasuerus saw something very, very unusual. When he ruled over Kippa, when he ruled over the entire globe, obviously every Jew was under his dominion. Amazingly, when he ruled over only 127 Medinos, still every Jew alive was under his rulership. It was almost like you could watch the province, and the determination of whether he would lose it or keep it was based on if there were Jews. Almost like a laser cutting out his borders. If there were Jews in this section, it remained in his power. If there were no Jews, it was taken from him. In a rebellion, in a major war, he was losing province after province, but each one remained if there were Jews in it. Each one was taken if there weren't. So that before the rebellion, before he lost his full rulership over the earth, he had ruled over every Jew alive. And when the rebellion was put down, when he solidified his kingdom again, he ruled over half of the world, and still every Jew was alive. He took it as a simon. He took it as a sign that Hashem is delivering his people into Ahasuerus' hands, and he was besimcha. Points out the Nesivos, he should have been broken, he should have been depressed, but he was given something that was so precious to him. Wow! The opportunity to kill the Jews, wow! And if you'd like to see an anti-Semite, this is an anti-Semite. A man who, despite the fact that he's driven, he's powerfully ambitious, he had ruled over the world, which is what he always dreamt of, and he lost it, but he wasn't depressed because he got something, a prize that might have been just as valuable, just as precious to him. I get to kill the Jews. Wow. And this is an interesting illustration of the evil of the man and in terms of quite how wicked he was and what a real old-fashioned anti-Semite in fact was. In any case, the Megillah tells us that he makes this party, and he invites all the royalty, all the nobles, makes a 180-day party, then a 7-day party, and at some point he invites the queen, Vashti, to come to his private party. Now, of course, he invites Vashti because Malchus wearing the crown, and Chazal tells us he invites Vashti to wear only the crown. Now, if you think about this, this is a rather insane request. It is a bazillion, it is an embarrassment to the monarchy to ask the queen to come forward naked. It's not respectful to the queen, it's not respectful to Ahasuerus, it is a foolish, insane move. And this is but one of the examples where Hashem puts thoughts into people's minds that aren't rational, that aren't intelligent. Any self-respecting monarch in a billion years wouldn't dream of doing this because it embarrasses himself. The queen is the king's personal object. Even if you're really a baltaiva, even if you're super into, you don't show it off. It's just not respectful to yourself. In any case, he calls her to wear a keser malchus, and Chazal tell us that she would have come just that way. She was not exactly the most sneeze woman in the world, and she would have walked out wearing the crown itself. However, either she sported a tail or pimples, whatever the case, she was so embarrassed that she didn't dare come out. And rather than just saying no, she was born of royalty, she was from Nebuchadnezzar's lineage, a granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar, she sent back a message to Ahasuerus that was a little bit harsh. She sent back the message, you know, my father knew how to drink, My father knew how to drink, and he would drink 100 times what you drink now, and he would never ask that. But not just that, my father's stable boy would drink 100 times what you drink, and he would never dream of embarrassing a person like this. She sent back words in a letter that were very derogatory, and Ahasuerus was furious. Vayiksof ha-melech ma'od, he was very angry, v'chamasov barobo, and his anger flamed within him. Now, we're going to soon see that he didn't just get angry, but he remained angry. In any case, he very quickly asked, what do we do? The Yodei Das Adin, which probably means the Sanhedrin, said we can't answer. Haman alone gives an advice, let's kill her, and that's in fact what they do. Now, the Eben Ezra points out that when his anger flared within him, we don't see this anger stopping for a very long time. This party is in the 3rd year of his melucha. It's in year 12 of his monarchy that the real action starts. That's where Haman is called in to Esther, together with the king, and muse of Ezra, who is this man who wants to kill you? Esther points a finger at Haman, and right then, Hasach happens to be there and says, and here's the tree that was prepared for Haman, let's hang him. And when Haman is hung on the tree, that's when v'chamas ha-melech shachacha, that's when the pasuk says the anger of the king was forgotten. And if you look on the Eben Ezra, in that pasuk, the Eben Ezra explains that the anger that Ahasuerus felt initially in year 3 only abated, only stopped in year 12 when he hung Haman. Meaning to say, he was furious. He was angry, even after he had Vashti killed, even after he selected a new queen, even after he now forgot the stuff you would think long ago, he still had an anger, a flaming anger within him. He couldn't be appeased. He couldn't be satisfied. He was a constant sort of low-key anger, and it wasn't until Haman was hung that this anger was put down, and this anger again lasted from year 3 to year 12, which sounds very difficult to understand. And I'd like to focus on that point per se. Meaning as follows. I've gotten angry. I'm sure you've gotten angry. We all get angry, maybe more, maybe less. Some people have more of a temper, some people less of a temper. But I don't ever remember being angry for any length of time. Someone says something wrong, so I get angry for a day, a week, a month, a year. How could a person be angry for 8 years? How could you still have anger? Now, granted, I don't think it was really like all day long, but sort of like a low-key anger, a low-key sort of upsetness, almost like, you know, when you're riding on the airplane, you know, hour after hour, you forget how loud it is until the airplane lands and they shut the jets down and then there's quiet. There was that low-key sort of anger year after year after year, and the question is why? And I'd like to share with you what I believe is an interesting yisod about kas, about anger in general. Do you know who you said that to? Do you have a clue who you just said those words to? Do you know how important I am? Do you know how chashav I am? Do you know what the audacity you had to say those words to me, the great, mighty, important me? You see, gaiva, arrogance, and anger are directly correlated. If I'm a humble, simple guy, a regular guy, what do you say? So you said something. Okay, you said something. I'm a little upset, more upset, less upset. But come on, what's the big deal? But the minute that there's arrogance in my heart, the minute that there's a sense of self-importance, the minute there's haughtiness, my kas, my anger, is going to be much more of an issue. I'm going to be much more sensitive to slights. I'm going to be much more sensitive to things that you said. More than anything, my honor is something that's very, very delicate. And I walk around with a bruised ego. I walk around with a sunburn on my ego because do you know who I am? Do you know how chashav I am? Do you know how important I am? And I never, ever get the kavod that's due to a mighty, significant, important person like me. Throughout my life, everyone doesn't understand how chashav I am. Everyone doesn't treat me with the right honor. No one appreciates who I am. And a person with an inflated ego walks around with a sunburn, on that ego, and all day long, every day, people are rubbing it. People, because no matter how much respect you treat the person with, you can never treat them with that due respect. Now, again, you and I, if we have an issue with gaiva, an issue with arrogance, we have to work on it, but it's doubtful that we'll ever be able to inflate the way that a monarch in the ancient world could. Remember, this man was a totalitarian dictator. This man had power that we can't even dream of. If he didn't like you, for whatever which reason, he killed you. If he did like you and you violated one of his laws, he killed you. This man had total, complete rulership. And as a result of that, he had the opportunity to inflate to an extent that's hard to imagine, to feel chashuv and important, until he was this wildly huge buffoon, this arrogant buffoon who had a head that was swelled to the size of a helium balloon, and no one could ever treat such a man with the honor due to him in his own mind, because no matter how much honor they treated him, I'm worth more. And that sense of ego, overinflated ego, caused him to be very, very sensitive, and the anger that ensued from it was such a powerful, flaming anger that it lasted for year after year after year. And again, this is just interesting because it helps us understand the relationship between arrogance and anger, and understanding how working on one helps one with the other. But let's proceed a little bit more. Let's get a little vision as to who the man was. Achar Dvarim Eila, after he has Vashti killed, when his anger abates a little bit, Zachar is Vashti, he remembered Vashti, and that which he did, and that was decreed on her. So he wakes up and he realizes Vashti, he remembers her, and he feels badly. Now, what is it about Vashti that he remembered? What is it that he felt badly about? Zachar is Vashti, says Rashi, is Yafyav in its Atsev, her beauty. Meaning to say, his relationship with his wife was one-dimensional. He didn't care about her. He didn't love her. He wasn't interested in what she had to say. Wasn't interested in her opinions. She was an object of beauty. Oh, drat, my Ming vase, my million-dollar Ming vase that was the rarest in the world, broke. Oh, I'm so upset. That was his wife. Meaning, again, just a little of an illustration into who the man was. His wife was an object, and not an object of depth, even an object of beauty. All she was a car or a painting or any sort of object that you acquire, and he lost it. Now, of course, he made the decision to have her be lost because she insulted his honor and etc. But the bottom line is, Nebuch, I lost my chashuv article. I no longer have it anymore. Let's proceed a little bit with the story. So in any case, he remembers Vashti. He then realizes that he's looking for another beauty. The advisors tell him make a beauty pageant. He sends out all the pekidim. They can't find anyone beautiful enough to satisfy him. Finally, Esther's called. V'nosas chein be'inei kol re'eha. Esther finds favor in the eyes of all who see her. Now, chein is a very interesting expression. It's true that Esther was one of the four most beautiful women who ever lived. Chazal tell us that she was up there with the Imos, with Sarah. She was of remarkable beauty. But that's not what the Pasuk says here. What the Pasuk says here is that she found favor in all who saw her. Now, chein is a very interesting expression. Sometimes we call it charisma, sometimes we call it a certain aura, but some people have a certain chein. They walk in the room, and you can't define it, you can't explain it, but they attract attention. All eyes turn to them. They just have a certain almost a magnetic glow to them. Chein is a magnetic glow with a very particular sort of nuance to it, where when you look at that person, you just like them. And I'd like to point out that this is not exactly understood in Western science, because beauty is beauty. Now, you could have a woman who you find more beautiful, a woman you find less beautiful. You could have your particular version of what's attractive, but that's not what chein is. Chein isn't beauty. The Pasuk didn't say she was a beautiful woman. The Pasuk said that whoever saw her liked her. There was a likability. And it wasn't because she said anything. And it wasn't even because she was a balas midos, which obviously she was. It was just her presence. And one of the strengths that Hashem gives people is a chein. Now, a wife should find favor in her husband's eyes. There should be a natural attraction that a husband and a wife have for each other. Obviously, on many levels, on a physical level, on an emotional level, but there should also be a chein. A chein is just a sort of almost supernatural sort of, you can't describe why, but you just like that person. And the reason why I focus on this is because it's important to understand that Hashem gives out different gifts to different people. Some people are given gifts of intelligence. Some people are given gifts of tremendous wisdom. Some people are given gifts of Yerusha, or of wealth. And some people are given a gift of Chen. Chen is a star quality that's not just star quality, as in causing me to look at that person and causing me to pay attention, causing me to look at that person and really finding that person attractive, and etc. In any case, whoever saw Esther was very much attracted to her. She found favor in all that saw her. And in fact, she was chosen by Ahasuerus to be the next queen. Now, interestingly enough, it's a machlokas in the Gemara whether she was married to Mordechai or just adopted by Mordechai. But Mordechai was very, very involved in every step of Esther's being in the throne and her involvement with Ahasuerus. And the pasuk tells us, Lo higida Esther es ama. Esther would not tell over which nation she came from, that's Moladasa, and her birth lineage, ki Mordechai tziva aleh shelo tagid, because Mordechai commanded her not to tell. Now Rashi explains, why is it that Mordechai told Esther not to tell? Because Esther came from royal blood. She was from the house of Shaul. And Mordechai was afraid. If we tell that she came from royal lineage, then it's more likely that Ahasuerus will take this woman. She is beautiful, remarkably beautiful. She has this remarkable chain. However, it's quite likely that Ahasuerus will not take her. Why? Because who knows what family she comes from. A king's not going to marry just a lowly person. So therefore, Mordechai told Esther, don't say what family you come from. Keep it a secret. Ahasuerus will assume you must come from lowly stock. He won't marry you. And why did Mordechai do this? Because his objective was to keep her away from this guy. She was a Jewish woman. Either she was married to Mordechai, or certainly even if she wasn't married, she's a Jewish woman. And for her to have to go ba'anus, to have to be oppressed and marry this Gentile, is a major, major issue. And obviously Mordechai did everything in his power to keep her out of the palace. So in fact, he told her, don't say, and hopefully what will happen is he won't take you. Now, in fact, that's not what happened. Despite the fact that in Ahasuerus' mind, she came from questionable lineage, Ahasuerus wanted her, took her as a wife. And the next pasuk tells us of a chol yom v'yom, every day Mordechai mishalach v'chatzar beis anoshim, daily, every single day Mordechai would go in front of the harem of the king, ladasa shlom Esther umaya sebo, to know the state of Esther and what will be done with her. Now Rashi explains, why is it that Mordechai went every single day? Keep in mind, even if he's related, even if he's an uncle or a husband or whatever it may be, you don't have to go for the daily update. Things don't change that quickly. And keep in mind that it was years, meaning from year 3 to year 7, until anything really happened. Right? The Hippel Pur, that entire routine about Haman throwing the lots and finding out which day is appropriate, wasn't until 4 years after Esther was taken. Yet every single day, day in and day out, Mordechai showed up at the harem, at the entrance to where Esther lived. He had a back and forth. There was a shliach who went back and forth to bring messages. And Rashi's troubled, but why is this tzaddik investing that much time on a daily basis to go back and forth? Explains Rashi, because Mordechai was one of two tzaddikim who were given a remez Yeshua, who were given a sign that a salvation for the Jewish nation are going to come through them. Who were these two tzaddikim? They were Mordechai and David. Rashi explains to us that David HaMelech, before he fought against Goliath, had two events happen to him. One day he was walking and he was attacked by a mountain lion. Now, a mountain lion is a little bit unlike an African lion. It doesn't weigh 400 pounds or 600 pounds, depending on male or female, but it weighs about 150 pounds, 200 pounds. It is a killing machine. A mountain lion can jump 15 feet up into the air, straight leap. A mountain lion is fast, its claws, it has teeth. It is literally a murdering machine. David HaMelech was attacked by this mountain lion, and with his bare hands, he killed him. Then later, David was attacked by a bear. Now, I don't know which species of bear, but a black bear weighs 600 pounds, brown bears more. But point being, a human being normally doesn't fight against a bear, certainly barehanded. And again, David HaMelech killed this bear barehanded. And David HaMelech took this as a sign. If I was attacked by the lion and somehow I vanquished it, if I was attacked by the bear and somehow I vanquished it, that's a simon. He took it as a sign that Hashem was going to give him unique and almost supernatural strength, and that he would win against Goliath. He said, this sign came to me, It's a sign from Hashem that so too I will win against Goliath. And he went in unarmed against Goliath. Keep in mind that Goliath was a giant. He was a giant of a man, and not a single Gibor in Klal Yisrael dared face him. Not only did David face him, he faced him without armor, without swords, without normal armor. He went out there because he had the simon, the sign. Rashi explains that so too Mordechai had a sign that a Yeshua was going to come to the Klal Yisrael. Salvation to the Klal Yisrael was going to come. Why? Because this woman, Esther, was a tzaddikus, a very, very righteous, very, very holy woman. We'd call her, you know, probably, certainly in the category of a Neviah, certainly one of the Gedolei Hador, one of the greatest women of a generation. For such a tzaddikus to be taken to a guy, to have to be married to a Gentile, is such an aberration. It's so unusual. There's only one way this can happen. Mordechai said it's a sign that Hashem is going to save the Jewish nation through this woman. Otherwise, this kind of a thing wouldn't have happened. Now, keeping that in mind, the Rishiva Zatzal asked a very interesting question. If Mordechai knew that a Yeshua, salvation of the Jewish nation, was going to come through this woman, and in fact, that's why she was taken to the king, wouldn't you imagine he'd do everything in his power to keep her in that position? Meaning Hashem wants to save the Jewish nation through this woman, and that's why Hashem had her taken to the king. Yet why is it that Mordechai told Esther, don't tell? And not only don't tell initially, every single day on a regular basis, Ahasuerus would ask Esther, what kingdom do you come from? What monarchy? What family? What's your lineage? Because it was something that troubled him. And in fact, when she came to Ahasuerus and made the party the first time, she said, come again tomorrow, you and Haman come tomorrow, and Omachar Esther Kedvar Melech, and tomorrow do what the king wanted. This is year 12 in the story. And she says, all of these years you've been troubled, you've been bothered by what family I come from. Come to the party tomorrow, and tomorrow I will tell you. Meaning for years, Ahasuerus wanted to know. For years, Esther wouldn't tell because Mordechai told her not to tell, because Mordechai wanted her out of the king, out of the king's clutches. But wait a minute, that's a contradiction. Because if Mordechai had a sign, Min HaShemayim, that this woman was supposed to bring the Yeshua for the Klal Yisrael, why is he trying to get her out of the monarchy? Why is he trying to get her out of the king's clutches? Her being there is going to save the Jewish nation. Mordechai, you're working against what Hashem wants. You're working against Hashem's plan. You're working against Hashem's Yeshua for the Jewish nation. And Rosh Hashanah Zatzal taught us a very interesting yisod. He said as follows. Mordechai had a sign that this woman was to be the salvation of the Jewish nation. That's the way Hashem was going to run the world. But we, as simple Jews, have a Shulchan Aruch, and we follow Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch states that when a Jewish woman is taken as a captive by a Gentile person, you have to do everything in your power to get her out. Even if you know that, well, it must be that Hashem is going to bring you, that's Hashem's business. How Hashem runs the world and Hashem's plans is Hashem's business, and what Hashem wants to do and not want to do is up to Hashem. But my job, my life, my actions are directed by Shulchan Aruch. I don't go up there into the upper world and figure out futures and past and what's going to be. My job is I'm given a Shulchan Aruch that directs me, that teaches me how to live, how to act. And what Mordechai was doing was exactly what the Shulchan Aruch says. I have a sign that Hashem wants to do. Hashem has many ways to run his world. My job is to follow the Shulchan Aruch and not get all carried away with these things. And in fact, the Shiva oftentimes would tell us that this is Das Torah. Our job is not to run the world. That's Hashem's job. Our job is to follow the Halacha and do as follows. In any case, the decree is set a number of years later by Haman. He walks into Ahasuerus and asks permission to kill his nation. The message is sent out to all of the Medinos that 11 months later, every person has the right to kill any Jew in their province, and they should do it. And in fact, any Jew that's left alive, any person who's responsible for that Jew being left alive will be killed themselves. Mordechai finds out about this decree before it's sent out. Chazal tell us, Al-Pi Ruach HaKodesh, and Malach came and told him what exactly was decreed and who, in fact, decreed it. And at that point, Mordechai, as the Gadol Hador, sat down in the middle of the square. He tore Kriya, and he began gathering the Jews around him. However, he also sent a message to Esther. Whilst Mordechai certainly understood that tshuva was the order of the day, because he understood that this decree was not by Haman, not by Ahasuerus, but was by Hashem. And he also knew the why behind it. He was told that it was because the Jewish nation were not doing what they were supposed to do, and therefore it was Hashem who decreed it. So Mordechai certainly understood that tshuva was the order of the day and what was required, but still he did a derech ha-teva ishtadlis, he did a attempt in the ways of the world. He sent a message to Esther to go into the king. The message was sent through Hasach. Hasach, according to Chazal, was Daniel. And Daniel was a advisor of the king, and in fact he was assigned to be the messenger of Esther. Anytime she needed anything, Hasach was available. And Mordechai sent in the message that there's been a decree against the Jewish nation, a decree to kill them out. I want you to go into Ahasuerus and beg him to renege. As soon as Esther gets this message, she sends back the following message. I hear you. It's a very wise idea. However, as follows. I have not been called to the king in 30 days. Now, everyone knows that if you walk into the king's throne room without being invited, unless he really finds favor for some reason and he puts down that sharbi dazov, puts down the scepter, you'll be killed. Achaz dasalami. The standard action is, if you walk in, even if you're the queen, walk into the throne room without being invited, you're killed. Now, I haven't been called for 30 days. Very likely he's going to call me in another few days, and then I'll be invited, and it won't be risky. If I walk in now, as you're asking me, I might be killed. Likely, I'll be killed. Says Esther to Mordechai, your idea is valid, your idea is proper, but let me wait a few days when he calls me, because when he calls me, obviously not going to kill me, because he called me. If I go in now, I might be killed. It's dangerous. Let me wait a few days. When he calls me, then I'll make that petition. I'll beg him for mercy. The next pasuk says that Mordechai was told of what Esther said to him, and Mordechai sends back a blistering message to Esther. Alti damech menafshech. Don't think that you're going to be saved from the king. Don't assume that because you're the queen, you'll be saved. Don't assume that the Jewish people will be killed and you'll be saved. Quite the opposite. Atu besavich tovedu. You and your family will be killed out. The Jews will be saved. Revach vatzol yamal liyudim makom acher. Salvation will come to the Jewish people from other place. You won't be the salvation. You and your family and your father's family will be killed out, and the Jews will be saved, and you better stop this. Rav Zatzal asked, what's going on here? Esther was saying words of logic. She was saying, I agree with you, Mordechai. I'm going to go in and beg, but right now it's not wise. If I walk in, it's dangerous. He might get angry. He might kill me. Let me wait till he calls me. I'll have a greater chance of succeeding. What Esther was saying was logical, and it seems like Mordechai just lost his temper and starts yelling at her, don't assume you're going to be saved. Don't assume you're safe because you're the queen. The Jewish nation will be saved, and your family will be killed out. Why is Mordechai getting all bent out of shape? Why is he using this tactic? Why is he taking this attitude? And Rav Shiva Zatzal explained to us that Mordechai was doing something called talking to the Negiah, talking to the little personal agenda that's oftentimes deep inside the heart of a person. You see, Mordechai perceived from what Esther said that on some level, deeply, deeply submerged in her subconscious was a sense of, I'm safe. Listen, I'm the queen. Jewish people may be in deep trouble, but I'm not going to die. And because she had that sort of very deeply submerged subconscious sort of safety net, she felt she had the liberty to wait a few days. No emergency, no rush, I'll wait. And it's safer that way. Had she really understood that she was as much in danger as everyone else, had she really understood that there is no safety net, she would have reacted differently. But because Mordechai perceived that on some level there was a sense that she's safe because she's in the palace, Mordechai spoke directly to the Negiah. He spoke directly to the agenda, to that little bias in her heart, and said, don't make a mistake, madam. You will not be safe in the kingdom. Hashem will save the Jewish people from another source. You and your family will die. What Mordechai was doing was talking right to the Negiah, avoiding all the peripherals and the outside things that we usually get confused with. He spoke right to Negiah, and in fact, Esther took those words of Musa appropriately, and in fact she said, fine, fast 3 days and three nights. I and my maidservants will do the same, and then I'll go into the king, and whatever happens will happen. Now, it's very interesting to note that the very next pasuk, actually pasuk Zion, says, Vayavar Mordechai violated, Vayas Gechol Hashem Sivsal of Esther, and he did all that Esther commanded him to do. Now Rashi is bothered by, what do you mean Mordechai violated? In other words, again, Mordechai told Esther, go in. Esther said, fine, I'll do it, but make sure first, fast. You and the Jewish nation should fast for 3 days. do a proper tshuva, and then I'll go in. Let's at least, you know, be wise about this. So the pasuk says that that's in fact what Mordechai did. He did just that. He told the Jewish nation to fast the next 3 days, and he violated. So Rashi Bach, what do you mean he violated? He did what Esther suggested. He told the Jewish people to fast. What did he violate? It says Rashi, Vayavar al das. He violated the religion. Lis anos biyud tes. He fasted. Lis anos biyumtuf, to fast on yumtuf, meaning to say, the fast day that Mordechai decreed was Yudalad Nisan, Tes Vav Nisan, and Tes Zion. You see, Rashi explains to us what's happening chronologically as follows. In year 7 of Ahasuerus' kingdom, Hippilpur, that's when Haman made this lottery, and he found that Yud Gimel of Adar, of 11 months later, was the best time to kill the Jews. So he walked in the very next day to Ahasuerus' throne room. The day that he walked in was Yud Gimel Nisan. On Yud Gimel Nisan, he walked into Ahasuerus and said, let's kill the Jews. Ahasuerus took his tabas, took his signet ring, gave it to Haman, and they sent out the decree. The next day was Yud Dalet Nisan. The next day after that was Tes Vav Nisan. The next day was Tes Zayin Nisan. Now, Tes Vav Nisan is Pesach. The 15th day of Nisan is Pesach. When Mordechai sent the message to Esther to fast, Esther said, fine, fast the next 3 days, then I'll go in. So right away, Mordechai gathered together the Jewish nation, and he decreed that the next 3 days, Yud Dalet, Tes Vav, and Tes Zayin Nisan, should be fast days. That year, Pesach, instead of the Jewish nation eating matzah, morah, drinking the Dalet Kosos, they sat in ashes with sackcloth and fasted. And Rashi says what it means that Mordechai violated, he violated the religion, he canceled the mitzvahs of matzah, morah, and Dalet Kosos, and they fasted those days. And this Rashi is rather difficult to understand, because why is Mordechai doing that? Okay, Esther had a good suggestion, fast for 3 days. So if you or I were there, wouldn't you assume that we would say as follows? Gather the Jewish people together. In fact, what Mordechai should do is make a huge gathering. Say, Rabosai, tomorrow is Pesach. Listen to me. Go home. Make sure that you have the best kavanas. Make sure that you eat the matzah with really pure thoughts. Make sure that you drink the dalet kosos if you never drank them before. Make sure you eat the morah as you never did. We need every merit. We need every schus. Go home. As soon as Pesach's over, I want you all to come back here, and then we'll fast for 3 days, and then we'll annihilate this decree. You see, keep in mind, he's standing there 11 months before the decree, and everyone knew that if Ahasuerus made a decree, then 11 months you kill a Jew, you don't dare kill a Jew a day before the 11 months are up, because Ahasuerus was very fickle. If you were to kill a Jew a month earlier, who knows what he'll do? He might just kill you. And in fact, the Jews knew that their life would end 11 months later on Yud Gimel Adar, but they knew that for 11 months not a single anti-Semite in the world would dare touch a hair on the head, because Ahasuerus might do who knows what. So if Mordechai is standing there and he knows that he has 11 months, wouldn't the logical thing to do be, gentlemen, go home, keep the mitzvahs of Pesach. After you're done, we'll have a 3-day tshuva rally. We'll do a complete tshuva, we'll fast, and then you have the mitzvahs, you have the schusim of the mitzvahs of matzah, morah, and dalet kosos, and you have tshuva. Obviously, that's the wisest approach. So why, in fact, did Mordechai command that this year there should be no matzah, no morah, and no dalet kosos? And I believe the answer is that Mordechai was doing something very, very wise called seizing the moment. You see, in the Igeres, the decrees were sent out to every single province. In the center of every province was a post. In the middle of the village, there was almost what we would call like a flagpole, but effectively a post. And any time the king sent out a decree, it was stapled to that post. And his decree was very clear and very detailed. It says, for me, Ahasuerus, I want you to know that a man came to me, a great man from Agag, from Amalek. He told me about this nation, this very insignificant nation. They offer nothing to us. They do nothing for us. And he offered me a tremendous sum of money. He offered me 10,000 talents of silver. I took this money, and I gladly accepted the offer to kill out this nation. Parenthetically, he didn't take the money. Remember, when Haman offered him the 10,000 talents of silver, He said, "Akesef nosan lach, keep the money. You don't have to. I'll gladly kill him without the money." But he didn't tell the people that. In his egeretz, he wanted it to seem that he wasn't quite as anti-Semitic as he really was. And so he said, "I accepted the money, and I said to Haman, it is a fine idea. So all of my servants, please understand that on the 13th day of Adar, every man, woman, and child should gather together in glee and joy and kill the Jews in your province. Do as I, your king, does, and know and understand that any province, any town, any area that I find a Jew in on the 14th, that province, that family will be killed out. Signed, your king, Ahasuerus." Ahasuerus was a mighty king, very, very powerful. And when the Jews read this decree, stapled in every town to the center post over there, they knew that their days were numbered. They knew it was over. What Mordechai recognized was that this is the moment. And at this moment, every Jew got it. We have no one to rely on. We can't rely on people. We can't rely on strategy. It's over. We have to turn to Hashem and Hashem only. And at that moment, what Mordechai did was he seized that moment and said, "Rabosai, now is the time. Now that every Jew gets it, now that every Jew understands it, let's turn to Hashem." He, in fact, created the greatest tshuva rally probably ever in history. And in fact, the decree was reversed because of the tshuva that the Jewish nation did then. But Mordechai knew that if he sent the Jewish nation home for 8 days, they would have eaten matzah, eaten marah. They would have come back motivated, but that fire wouldn't have been to the same degree. They would have known they're in trouble. But there'd been time for things to settle in, you know, time for things to normalize. And that pitch fever excitement, that clarity of thought, that if we don't totally change our ways, if we don't turn to Hashem with a total, complete acceptance, we are finished. That pitch fever would have been lost, and in fact, the tshuva might not have been worked. And therefore, for that reason, Mordechai decreed, now is the time. He seized the moment, and he abolished those mitzvahs. But in fact, he did what was right and was appropriate, and in fact, it worked. Nodeh doshna samelach. Perek Vav opens up with the fact that Hashem's sleep, if it could be, was awoken. Hashem accepted their tshuva. And then we get to the more colorful, almost more enjoyable part of the Megillah, when Haman walks in to the king's throne room. Now, let's keep in mind something very interesting. Ahasuerus was not known to be a tolerant, benevolent fellow. For some strange reason, in the middle of the night, Haman walks into his private bedroom, not just into the throne room, into the king's private bedroom. This is about as bright a move as walking into a lion's mouth. Meaning, Haman, what are you thinking? And again, this is one example. There are many, many examples where Hashem puts insane thoughts into people's minds because what Haman did was extraordinarily irrational. You don't walk in the middle of the night into this king Ahasuerus' private bedroom and wake him up. Now, in fact, Haman didn't wake up Ahasuerus because Ahasuerus happened to have been having a dream. But the Midrash tells us that it wasn't just a dream, it was a nightmare. It was a nightmare that was so vivid, so palpable, that he woke up sweating. He saw somebody trying to murder him. He saw someone trying to kill him. And it was so vivid that he woke up sweating. And the first thing that he thought is, "Oh my goodness, I'm being sent a message. Someone is out to get me. Who is it? Why? Why would they want to kill me? Why? Wait a minute, it must be I've done something wrong. Must be one of my friends. I've not paid back a good. Maybe that's why no one's telling me. Quick, 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 Shimshi," who was Haman's son, "bring me the book of Chronicles. Bring me the book of all the events. I have to review the history. I have to review what, maybe someone did me a favor. I didn't pay them back. I lost my belief of credibility and people aren't going to tell me who's out to get me." So Shimshi, being Haman's son, brings the book and opens up astonishingly to a strange event. There are these two people, Bigsam and Seresh. They were in the king's private court. They decided to kill the king. They decided to poison the king. And Mordechai the Jew told the king about it. We researched the matter, found it was true, and they were hung. However, Shimshi didn't read those words. Those were the words that were on the page. But as soon as Shimshi just opened the book to anywhere, as Ahasuerus commanded him, he saw those words and he said, "Oh my goodness, wait a minute. I wrote those words. And I also erased them." You see, Shimshi was the scribe. And when in fact that happened, Ahasuerus told him what to write, and Shimshi wrote those words. But Shimshi also immediately, after the king was no longer there, erased them because they didn't want them in the public record. And a malach came and rewrote them. But strangely enough, not only were the words rewritten, but when Achashverosh says open to anywhere, that's the page that opens up. So what does Shimshi do? He quickly turns the page. And somehow the page gets turned back. Turns again, back and forth, back and forth. Chazal tell us the malach was basically manipulating, moving the page back. And Achashverosh hears the rustle, stop, read from there. So Shimshi, much against his will, starts reading. There was a big samisarish, they wanted to kill the king. Mordechai, the Jew, told you about it, and we found it was true, and we killed them, and the king was saved. At that moment, Achashverosh says, I get it. Haman, Esther, Mordechai, I got it. Haman and Esther are planning to have an affair. They're going to kill me. That's why Esther invited me and Haman to the party today. That's why tomorrow she invited me and Haman. Why does she want Haman to come? Well, people, me, I understand, I'm the king. Why does she want Haman? She has her eye on Haman. They plan to kill me. My one friend is this guy, Mordechai. And the reason why he's not told me is because last time he did me this great service and I didn't pay him back. And that's what's going to happen. As soon as the light bulb went off in Achashverosh's mind, Vayavo Haman, in walks Haman. 2 a.m. into the king's private bedroom. He shows up to tell him, ask him permission to hang Mordechai on this very tall tree that he prepared for him. And at that moment, it all became obvious. My friend Mordechai, he wants to kill. He and Esther have this plot. They're going to kill me. So Achashverosh looks at Haman and says, tell me something. If we wanted to treat someone with honor, if we wanted to really give them covet, what would we do? Now keep in mind that as much as Achashverosh was a driven human being, very motivated by honor and covet, Haman was his equal. And Achashverosh knew quite well that Haman was super into his honor. And so he asked him a very powerful leading question. If we wanted to treat a person with true honor, what would we do? Haman, not realizing what he's getting himself into, says, well, what we would do is we would take the king's horse, take the king's coat, take the king's crown, put this man on the king's horse, adorn him in the king's cloak, and put the king's throne right on top, put his crown right on top of this man. And that exactly when Achashverosh really understood the full gravity of the plot. When I asked this man Haman what we should treat a person with honor, Achashverosh knew full well that Haman assumed it was Haman himself that the king wanted to honor. And what does he ask for? He asks for the king's horse, the king's cloak, the king's crown. He wants my throne. And at that point, says Achashverosh to Haman, fine, take the horse, take the cloak. Notice, please, he leaves out the crown because that he wasn't giving to anyone else. Take the horse, take the cloak, and do that to Mordechai HaYehudi HaYoshev B'Shar HaMelech. Do that to Mordechai the Jew who's sitting in the Shar, in the courtyard of the king. Now the Medrash explains that even though when you read the Psukim it seems to be a straight chronological order, this was actually a conversation. Because the Medrash explains that when Achashverosh said the words, that which you just described, I want you to do that to Mordechai, at that point Haman's knees start to knock, his body starts to tremble, his teeth start to chatter. Do that to Mordechai? There are many, many, many Mordechais in your majesty's kingdom. Mordechai HaYehudi. Your majesty, there are many Jews named Mordechai. Mordechai HaYehudi Ayushi B'Shar HaMelech. Mordechai the Jew who's the head of the Sanhedrin. Achashverosh was pointing out directly who I mean. At which point the Medrash says that Haman began a strategy, a gambit to save himself from having to do that. He said, Your Majesty, remember those 10,000 talents of silver, which is a king's ransom. Remember I promised this to Your Majesty and you didn't take it. Please take that money and don't give this covered to Mordechai. Says Achashverosh, I will take the money and you will still do the honor. Please, Your Majesty, I have 10 sons. Let them become avodim. Let them become slaves to you, but don't give him this honor. I will take your 10 sons as servants, and you will still give him this honor. And then the Medrash says he gave the final most valuable thing. Your Majesty, you remember that decree, that decree to kill the Jews? Abolish that decree, but please, please don't give him this honor. Says Ahasuerus, I will abolish this decree, but nevertheless you will still give him this honor. First of all, interesting to note his order of priorities, money first, his children second, and then the most valuable thing. He was willing to give up everything, that last thing, the decree to kill the Jews. But let's focus on what is going on here. Assuming that Haman is a rational, sane person, what is his problem? You're being asked to give excuse me, some cover to Mordechai. Okay, let's grant that Mordechai is your enemy, and let's grant that it's going to be a bit uncomfortable. Let's grant that you're going to be embarrassed and, you know, having to give him the honor is going to be something you don't enjoy. But why are you willing to sacrifice so much? You're willing to give up 10,000 talents of silver, a king's fortune. You're willing to give up your 10 sons a servant. You're willing to give up that which you consider the most valuable thing in the world, your decree to kill the Jews. Why don't you just give Mordechai the honor and keep those things? You'll go through a day of pain, a day of embarrassment, but it's worth it. The answer to this dilemma is understanding what kavod and a drive for kavod does to a human. When you get into kavod, there's nothing sweeter, nothing more desirous. You need it, you have to have it, and you become a driven human being. My honor, my kavod. I can't stand to give someone else kavod. It's being stolen from me. I need it, I have to have it. You become hugely hungry, you become aggressive for it, it becomes something that absolutely encompasses your entire life, you become a slave to honor. When we see people making bar mitzvahs or weddings that they can't afford, when we see people buying houses and cars that they can't even dream of paying, we're watching a small example of kavod driving them, of this illusionary honor, as if anyone really cares, as if anyone really notices. So that illusionary thing makes them do things that are silly. But when you get to see it blown up in full proportion, when you get to see real drive of kavod and see how damaging and devastating it is, it's very eye-opening. Because at the very end, when Haman knows that he's going to be killed, he begs again for mercy. But you have to hear his cries. He begs to Mordechai, please kill me in an honorable way. Please kill me in the way that honorable people are killed. Please don't hang me. That's dishonorable. Please have respect for me, for my name. And he gets on his knees and begs Mordechai, please don't hang me. That's not kavod. And if you want to see insanity, this is the man you hate. This is the man that you've lived your life to destroy. And you realize he won. And now you're facing death. What difference does it make to you? You're dead, you're dead, you're dead, you're dead. Dead as a doornail, whether you're hung, whether your head's cut off, whether you're burned, you're still going to be the same dead. I can't stand the dishonor. I have to be killed in an honorable way. Haman, the great Haman, has to leave the world with honor. And you see what honor does to a person. It's very frightening, and it's very scary, and it's very eye-opening. Let's take one more step in this area. Before, in fact, the whole thing plays out, Mordechai is called by Haman. Ahasuerus told Haman, go bring Mordechai, put him on the sus, put on the cloak of the king, and march him through the streets of Shushan and say the words, Kachay Yasel Ish Hashem Melech Hafiz Bikaro. So Gemara tells us that in fact Haman goes to Mordechai and calls him and tells him what has to happen. Mordechai says, it's not going to happen. I can't wear the king's coat. I can't ride on the king's horse. I'm not bathed, I haven't haircut, it's not appropriate, I can't do that. Now the Mefarshim explained that basically Mordechai was doing what's called Tamas Nafshi in Pelishtim. He was basically trying to get Haman not to fulfill the request of the king. Why? Because if in fact Haman would not be able to fulfill the king's request, then Haman would be killed. So Mordechai knew that likely he would die as well, but he was figuring out all kinds of plots and all kinds of ploys to make sure that Haman would not be able to put him on the king's horse, would not be able to parade him. Thereby, both of them would be killed, but once Haman would be killed, the tzivoy, the command of the king, would be nullified, and the Jews would be saved. In any case, what Mordechai said was, I can't ride on that horse because I'm not bathed and I'm not properly prepared. I haven't taken a haircut or a shave. Esther sent out the word to close every bathhouse in all of Paras and Madai. And Haman faced a very interesting situation. He had to bathe Mordechai. And Mordechai made it as difficult as possible and really put it, as they say, in his face as much as he could, and made Haman go through every one of these attempts to disrobe him, he had to wash Mordechai, he had to go through every step, and Mordechai was constantly in his face trying to embarrass him, again, trying to incite Haman to lose his temper, maybe kill Mordechai, but whatever happens, that it should be that Haman should not accomplish what he wanted. In the end, Haman did everything he had to, and he sits down Mordechai and starts giving him a haircut, and he lets out a groan. And Gemara says, he lets out a groan, and Mordechai says, "What are you groaning for?" "What am I groaning for?" says Haman. "A man of my honor, for me to have to be a barber, for me to have to cut a person's hair?" And turns Mordechai to Haman and says, "Russia, wicked one, weren't you a barber?" And the Gemara tells us that for 22 years in the Kfar of Kurtzim, Haman was the barber. Now let's focus on this conversation, because keep in mind that anything that Chazal tell us has a lesson and has something to teach us. Why is Mordechai calling him a Rasha because he lets out a groan? I mean, listen, the man had been a barber for 22 years. Baruch Hashem, I'm no longer that. Now I'm the most honored man in all of Paras Hamadai. I'm wealthy, I'm rich. Thank God I've eradicated that. What Haman did by groaning made a lot of sense. He remembered his past, remember what he left, and it hurt him so much to have to go back to it. Why does that make him a Rasha? And if you understand how Gaiva works, I think you'll understand why. You see, for this act of cutting a man's hair to bother Haman means he had to do something very, very necessary for any Baal Gaiva. Gaiva, arrogance by definition, is delusional. You have to eradicate history, and you have to assume that I'm powerful, I'm mighty, I'm invincible. You see, if I remember that I'm a mortal flesh and blood, I'm going to die. If I remember that I fall asleep at night, that I'm powerless, that I'm a weak, frail human, I would never be arrogant. The only way a person can be arrogant is if they live in a world of delusion. If they create these fanciful mindsets where history didn't happen, I'm never going to die, I'm all powerful, I'm super invincible, and they create these worlds of illusions. Had Haman not eradicated his past, had he been a normal human being and realized, I was a barber, and now I'm the viceroy, he would have understood that this is the kind of thing I have to do, or I never have to do. The fact that it bothered him so much meant that he had eradicated that whole part of his history. The 22 years that he had been a barber, in his mind, were no longer there. He erased it, because it wouldn't be possible to be really arrogant if you remembered your past. The Chronim tell us, the way to remain humble is to remember where you come from, to remember your beginnings, to remember where you're going to end up. The only way a person can become arrogant is they live in the bubble of now. They feel this illusion of impenetrability. They're invincible. They're mighty. But that delusion is completely fabricated and false. The fact that Haman was a barber and this bothered him proved how much he eradicated history. Says Mordechai, you're a Rasha. At that point, Haman realizes where this is going. He takes Mordechai out and he parades him through the streets. Now, in any case, Mordechai is paraded through the streets. Haman comes back to his house, and we'll touch on one last point because I think it's so powerful and so interesting. Vayisaper Haman lezeresh ishto l'chol ovav. Haman, after parading Mordechai through the streets, says to his wife Zeresh and all of his beloved, all of his friends he gathered. Now Zeresh is called a chachama. She's called a wise woman. She apparently had great wisdom. In any case, he told them all that had occurred, everything that happened. V'yomer chachamav Zeresh ishto, the wise men and Zeresh's wife said, if this Mordechai is Jewish, the fact that you started falling in front of him, lo tuchalo, you won't be able to vanquish him, ki nofal tipolofanov, you're going to fall. So all the wise men and Zeresh together say to him, Haman, don't you understand? If this Mordechai is Jewish, you're in big trouble. We never realized this before. But if he's Jewish, you're finished. You started to fall, you're going to continue to fall. Now, this pasuk is rather difficult to understand. Zeresh is a wise woman. There's been a fight between Haman and Mordechai for decades now. They didn't just meet in the Megillah. The Gemara tells us that they had been generals in Ahasuerus' army previously. They knew well about one another. And Haman hated Mordechai, who was the Rosh Sanhedrin, because Mordechai was the Jew who represented God. As a matter of fact, Kol Ze'ena Shoveli, when Haman comes back and says, all that I have, my wealth, my glory, my 10 children, it's worth nothing to me. When I see Mordechai Yehudi Yoshe B'Shar Melech, when I see Mordechai the Jew sitting in the Sanhedrin, the Targum tells us, what echoed Haman beyond anything was that Mordechai was the head of the Sanhedrin and he would sit and paskin Dinei Torah. And that's what bothered him. It was Kedusha, it was holiness, it was God's representative. That's what echoed him. So comes back Haman and says, what happened? Says his wife, Zeresh the wise one, oh, wait a minute. If he's Jewish, you're in big trouble. Madam, were you paying attention to the plot line? Mordechai, Haman, Mordechai the Jew. Oh, if he's Jewish, you're in trouble. Says Rashi, it wasn't what she was saying. And Rashi was saying, Umazu, this nation, Nimshulu Kachovim Ula Ofer. This nation is compared to the stars in the sky and the dirt in the ground. When they fall down, they fall to the ground and anyone can walk on them, you can trample on them. When they rise up, they rise to the heights, they rise to the stars. Says Zeresh to Haman, don't you get it? There's been a reversal. Yes, you were able to make the decree because the Jewish people had sinned. They were lowly, they were like the dirt, and anyone could have killed them. But obviously it's been turned around. They did tshuva. They're now like the stars in the sky. They're untouchable. It's over. And at that moment, Haman got it. At that moment, he understood. There's a lot more to be learned in the Megillah. And again, I recommend the 4-CD set. It's, again, available in CD as well as online. It's Megillah's Esther, the story behind the story. But we'll stop here at this point.